Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Juan Anchondo joins us today. He's a medical surgical nurse at Las Palmas Medical Center in El Paso, Texas. Juan, welcome to the show.
Hello, how are you?
I'm well. We really want to know how you are. How much has the pandemic defined your work in your life in the past couple of months?
It just reinforces for me what I want to do as a profession, and that's being what I'm doing right now as a registered nurse. You know, seeing people get better. It's hard because I've never seen it like this before in my 17 years of being a registered nurse.
And when you say like this, what is the this you're talking about?
Oh, our current pandemic situation that we're in right now, especially over here in El Paso with the us being in the news as of lately. And it's a struggle right now.
Well, so for people who don't know, El Paso is a major hotspot in
yes.
Texas, right? They had to open field hospitals, their mobile mm-hmm. morgues. There are many
yes.
Paso, families in El Paso who've lost multiple family members. I think I've even read that folks, because the hospitals are essentially full there, folks have, in some cases have been airlifted out to other cities. So the El Paso is in the tight grip of this tragedy. But I want to hear from you, Juan, about you work a 12-hour shift every day when you walk into the hospital, right? So can you tell us a little bit about what that's like from the moment you sort of cross through the doors in the Las Palmas Medical Center?
On the days that I work the COVID floor, you go in and you're like, what am I expecting today? What am I going to find today? You go in, you get your temperature checked. Somebody asks you, have you had a fever today? You're like, no. They give you a little simple mask. You go to the floor that you go to, COVID floor, and you have to put your stuff away. You get into some generic surgical scrubs. You get your N95. Some of us prefer to also put another like a surgical mask on top of your N95. And for a while, we used to have hair coverings and shoe coverings as well, but our management told us that, you don't need that anymore. We're not going to supply that stuff anymore. So all we have is the gowns when we actually go into the rooms, and also just the N95s that you have to wear all 12-hour shift. So you have to be emotionally ready to start taking care of these patients. You have to get report from the nurses that were there in the morning, because since I work at nights. You find out what treatments they're on, how much oxygen they're on, how many treatments are they into, like let's say the remdesivir or dexamethasone that they're getting. And you find out how they're saturating in oxygen with that oxygen, which doctors have gone in to see them. So you have to get ready for all this stuff, and sometimes you go in there and see these patients, and sometimes you're like, the oxygen levels are not that good. So you have to adjust their oxygen a little bit, and since I like to talk to my patients, and I get to find out how they're doing, like if any other family members have gotten sick. And sometimes you hear these stories, like Oh, my grandson came to visit me a few weeks ago, and he was asymptomatic, but that's where I got it from. And also, my husband is in the same hospital, and my daughter as well. You just hear a lot of stories, so you just have to be emotionally ready and to hear what the patients are saying, how they're doing in their treatment. It just you just have to take it a little bit at a time throughout your shift. Mm-hmm. It's 12 hours is a long time, and sometimes time doesn't pass quickly.
Can I just ask you? So you get an N95, and you can put a surgical mask over it. But do you get any other kind of face covering, face shield, or anything like that?
Oh, you know what? They did provide us with you can have a face shield. They'll provide that for you. I have some goggles that I bought for mm-hmm. myself. It really covers really nicely your eyes, and it really hugs your face. Mm, okay. So hopefully, like, nothing gets in there.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Juan, how different is this from when I say this? I mean, treating COVID patients in the middle of this terrible spike that's been ongoing in El Paso. How different is it than the nursing that you had been doing for the previous 17 years?
Well, this time, I'm concerned that I can bring something to my family, or I have an 11-year-old, I have a wife. My routine would be before the pandemic was just to come in, say hi to everybody, hug them, and then maybe take a shower and then go to sleep, and then have to wake up and do it all over again. Now I just straight from the car, I go straight into a bathroom that I have that's next to the garage, take a shower before I see anybody or acknowledge anybody. Quickly put my scrubs in the washing machine that's next to the restroom. Take my shower, and then once I'm dressed and everything, then I'll say hello to everybody. But no kiss, no kiss. Hello to from me. That's part of it. So I'm scared to take it. I'm scared to take COVID home. Mm. And I used to see my elderly mom. She's 83. She's on the other side of a town. I would see every week, and now I haven't seen her in a few months, because I don't want to get her sick. Because I do take care of some of these patients when I get floated to that floor.
Well, Juan, we're so glad that you could join us today, and we're going to hear from other nurses as well. Because, look, I have had. Over the past many years, a couple of times I've received hospital treatment myself, and just my personal experience is that the number one point of patient contact is nurses, right? Like, when I was in the hospital, I felt like the nurses became my best friends, you know, because they were the ones always at the bedside. No offense to the doctors. The doctors were great. And all the other members of a hospital community. But the nurses were the ones that, like, held my hand and talked to me. They were there. They were checking my vitals. They were the ones coming in every half hour overnight, you know, when I was there after my kids were born. So There's something about the intimacy of the kind of patient contact and the kind of care that nurses do mm-hmm. and what that means in this pandemic that we want to explore with all of you. So if you can just hang on for a second, Juan.
Absolutely.
I want to listen to a moment from back in March, at the beginning of this pandemic, when we talked to some nurses back then, too. And here's what one of them shared with us.
So it's definitely a marathon. Healthcare is very different right now. I've been a nurse for about 30 years, and this is a very different time than I've seen before.
Have you ever seen anything like this?
to me, I also do disaster nursing with our national disaster medical teams, and it reminds me a little bit of that. But with that, I go out for 2 weeks and I come back, right? Mm-hmm. And here, you're living it.
Well, that's Mary Jo Kelly. She's a critical care clinical nurse specialist at the University of Washington Medical Center Northwest Campus. And she's back with us today from Seattle. Mary Jo Kelly, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you, Magna. It certainly never thought that this marathon would continue to on this long.
I was just going to ask you, you're still running that marathon.
Yep. It is a busy time. And it's a little bit different than in March, right? In March, we are winning with a lot of patients. They were getting better. We were having a lot of success. Right now, it seems like people are even with COVID are even more sick, if that's even possible, because they're the sickest of the sick. But we're not winning as much. More patients are dying, and it's tough. It's tough on staff. It's hard to continue. I'm listening to Juan's story, and we're all telling you it's tough. And, when you look at the science of resiliency, it says, you want to gather your team to support you. And we really can't do that right now, because then we can spread the virus among, each other. This is very hard for nursing and healthcare in general.
Yeah. I think when you describe to us how going home, you have to take that shower outside your home, and the normal routine of just, embracing and giving your loved ones a kiss is no longer an option for as long as there's this threat. I think that's the thing that people don't really understand about how healthcare workers are living this, whether you're on shift or off shift. So I want to hear more about how you're dealing with that when we come back from a break. We're talking with nurses as we enter month 9 of this pandemic. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast. Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we are talking with nurses from across the U.S. healthcare system as this nation pushes into the 9th month of the COVID-19 pandemic. And those numbers, those new positive cases, and the death rates continue to rise. Now, we have several nurses who are On Point listeners. Thomas Bennett is one of them. He's a registered nurse at a critical care center in Southern California, and he called us to tell us this.
One of the most painful things I have witnessed in the hospital is the isolation that many of my patients experience at the end of their lives. Many of my patients are dying with only a nurse present. We have facilitated video calls, and I have heard loved ones crying. I have heard loved ones singing. I have heard loved ones praying. And it is heartbreaking to be at the bedside when those family members cannot be and a patient dies.
And that isolation is also having an impact on Thomas himself.
being a healthcare worker working with coronavirus patients, I do not dare to spend time with family. I do not spend time with friends. This pandemic has taken a toll on me because I have been more isolated than ever before.
That's Thomas Bennett, a nurse at a critical care center in Southern California. I'm joined today by Juan Anchando, a medical surgical nurse at Las Palmas Medical Center in El Paso. Mary Jo Kelly is also with us. She's a critical care clinical nurse specialist at the University of Washington Medical Center Northwest Campus, and she's with us from Seattle. Mary Jo, let me just quickly ask you. You said that that you're not winning as often now.
Yeah.
Even in Seattle, that got hit so hard so early on.
Right. And I think most of our COVID intensive care patients are coming from another part of town, right? From one of our sister hospitals, that the whole south end of King County is being hit harder than any other part of our area. So we take patients from there as well as our own patients. And a lot of that, you know, a lot of these patients are because people are not following the guidelines. They're not wearing masks. They're not social distancing. I'm really fearful what's going to happen in 2 weeks and how bad we're going to be inundated after Thanksgiving. I hear Juan's fear. I have my own fears of contracting this, and I look at the number of healthcare workers that have died from COVID, and that's not what any of us signed up. We signed up to help people, but people, you know, the public has to help us too. And it's time to really do the right thing, and we need people to social distance, wear masks, and when the vaccine's available, get the vaccine, right? That's how we're going to get out of this pandemic.
Mm-hmm. Juan, did you want to add to that?
Yeah, the whole thing also, besides wearing the mask, social distancing, is maybe assign one person to go get what you need to get from the store, like essential items. Because sometimes on my way to work, going down the freeway, over here in El Paso, there's this one mall that's always the busiest for many years. And it's still full to the, you know, you see the parking lot all the way full. And you see clumps of a big family going into the main entrance, you know, with little kids and multiple adults. You know, why is it that they have to all shop together? You know, just maybe one person if you're getting essential items, and you know that's it. You know, you can get your stuff on the internet now, or some places locally can bring it to your front door. You know, these are like suggestions that people can do, but some people just want to kill time at the mall. That's not the right time to do it right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, Juan, you're in El Paso, and Mary Jo, you're in Seattle. And in a few minutes, we're going to bring in a nurse from New York. So three major U.S. cities. And of course, this pandemic, it isn't discriminating between cities and rural areas by any means. I mean, right now we're in a portion of the pandemic where rural America is being hit especially hard. So we also wanted to hear from a nurse working there. And we spoke with nurse practitioner Adam Homan, who lives in North Dakota and works for Minnesota-based Essentia Health. And he has been working in rural parts of the state.
What we're seeing, particularly from the nursing staff, is they too are extremely tired and burned out. Many of them are working 36 hours above their scheduled FTE at this point. You know, we're seeing a lot of sick patients. I've been in the emergency department the last few days, and it seems that almost every third or fourth patient is either someone who's suspicious they have COVID or they're diagnosed with COVID and they're coming in with complications now. Relatively recent here last week, it was towards the end of my shift, and we had a very elderly gentleman who was about the same age as my grandmother, who had kind of been sick for about a week, but really was kind of okay at home with his wife, and he became extremely ill the night that I took care of him, and required mechanical ventilation, required lots of IV fluids, required medications to help with his blood pressure. And despite all that, he was still very ill and doing poorly. And when his family was finally able to arrive and we could talk at the hospital, they decided that he was just too ill, and this is not what he would want for his care. And so they opted to transition to comfort care with him, and he died about 9 minutes after we transitioned to comfort care. And it was kind of that moment where COVID's always been kind of real for me, because I've been dealing with it on different fronts in the last 8 months. And, you know, this could have been my grandmother, who does not live too far from where I work. And so at that point, it became a lot more mentally distressing for me. It's just barriers they face day to day in rural America. One of the things that, depending on the size of your hospital and depending on the size of your community, with some rare exceptions, of course, there are very few what we call critical access hospitals who have respiratory therapists, who have an anesthesia team, who even, frankly, have ICU beds. Most of those facilities in rural America, particularly in North Dakota, which I can speak to, most of those are run by family practice providers, whether they are physicians, nurse practitioners, physician assistants. Their emergency departments are often staffed by those types of providers. A lot of them don't have a significant amount of ventilators, if any. And if they do, they probably don't have a lot of people who can run the ventilator in those facilities. They also have issues with staffing. You know, they don't have a big staffing pool to pull from in a rural setting. You know, one of the things that we oftentimes will rely on are staffing agencies that bring in nursing staff, but with an entire nation dealing with their own COVID crisis, those resources are, you know, pretty thin right now from what I'm understanding from the field. The ability to just have some relief is probably the biggest thing that nurses need right now.
That's Adam Homan, a nurse practitioner who works in rural Minnesota. Well, Ellen Arigarat joins us now from New York. She's a clinical nurse informaticist at New York Presbyterian Hospital. Ellen, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Meghna.
And I'm so glad to have you and Mary Jo and Juan able to join us today. These themes of needing relief, of resilience, of the toll that this 9-month-long disaster is having on healthcare workers is clearly one of the hearts of the discussion today. And I'm just wondering, Ellen, has the work that you've had to do over this past year, has that had an impact on your mental health?
Yes. You know, hearing Juan's story kind of triggered flashbacks of when I was redeployed, and just the feeling of burnt out and hopeless at points. But then you start to look at hope, right? And I started to kind of feel a little emotional just listening to Juan's story, because I can relate. Prior to my deployment back to clinical bedside, I watched my own mother and prepared my own mother to be deployed. I'm in a household with two generation nurses, and so to watch my mother, who has been at a bedside for, I guess, 10, 15 years, preparing to put scrubs back on and not know what are the proper protocols to care for COVID patients, made me realize that I have to prepare myself as well when I go back to take care of patients.
So tell me more. First of all, thank you, and thank you to your mother as well for putting those scrubs back on. And what has it been like for you to go back to the bedside in the hospital?
So I'm I've been removed from clinical bedside for 3 years. And to go back and step back on the floor was kind of nerve-wracking, as one can imagine being away from patient care. However, once you step foot on that floor and you introduce yourself, there's some sigh of relief from nurses because now they have someone else to help them. And so you just see camaraderie, teamwork, and just more motivation to get their patients through COVID and to get themselves through COVID. You know, taking care of patients, holding them, holding their hands and talking to them, even though they can't talk for themselves, just to reassure them that you're there, is worthwhile to say the least.
Hmm. And they can't talk for themselves because they've been intubated?
No, you know, with COVID, a lot of it takes a lot of their breathing reserve.
Of course, they're struggling to breathe, right?
Yeah. So then if they start to talk, then it requires them to breathe some more. So what I would do is just say, you don't have to talk. Just here. You can listen. You could nod. But I'm just here to give you support through your hospitalization, and then make sure that, you know, when they leave, they're at peace with that somebody's there, and, you know, to make sure that even my own coworkers, who kind of welcomed me with open arms, is aware that I'm there for them as well if they need someone to talk mm-hmm. to or someone to help them with their patient care. Mm-hmm. I'm there for them.
Now, Ellen and Mary Jo and Juan, in a large sense, like I would love to hear the three of you talk with each other. I mean, and swap notes even. I mean, what is it that are there stories that the three of you want to share, or maybe things that you think is important for listeners who are hearing this to know? Just jump in, any one of you. Go ahead.
So what I found, now that I'm back to my clinical informaticist role, what I found during the height of the pandemic was that a lot of nurses found their purpose and finding what drives them to become a nurse. And so that was one of the missions that I kind of took upon myself afterwards, and as a part of my healing process, suffering from PTSD, was that, how do I make myself purposeful to take care of my patients and my community, and also work and be a voice for my mother, who is an immigrant Filipino nurse, who was brought in here to alleviate the 1980s to the 1990s nursing shortages. And so, you know, when you look at articles about immigrant Filipino nurses as commodities, it kind of just hurts because the sacrifices they did. And, you know, knowing that someone close to you died because of COVID, it's not as warm and fuzzy feeling when someone says, oh, they're commodities, and that, you know, we can't, Philippines is just pushing them out because to speak for the shortages, you know, these people, these nurses, these women have strength and resilience to go through and go back to bedside to take care of patients. And that is something that I admire in them and applaud for them.
Mary Jo, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, I think one thing, like I think that not only are healthcare workers struggling with resiliency, but I think the general public, right? If they've been, trying to social distance and working from home, it's hard. But I think we all have to dig down, and we have to find the strength to keep doing this, so that, we can get through this pandemic. It is not easy, right? I would love to see my family on Thanksgiving. I would love to see my family on Christmas, but I don't know that Christmas is going to be possible. It wasn't possible for Thanksgiving. Until there's a vaccine, I don't want to give this to anybody. as well. I think that one of the things that's really hard is to see your colleagues. We have been fortunate. I have been fortunate that none of my colleagues have developed COVID into the fact that they have to be hospitalized in the ICU. But we've had many of my colleagues have developed COVID despite using all the proper personal protection equipment because of community exposure, right? If somebody brings it into their home or something, it hasn't been necessarily acquired at work. And the death rate around healthcare workers is very high. Mm-hmm. So trying to make sure that we can do what we can to protect each other is important. I think Juan brought up, your listener from California brought up one of the issues that we struggle with is that communication with our families. We like to provide patient-centered care. And for the last 9 months, we haven't been able to do that. It's just hard.
Well, Mary Jo and Ellen and Juan, I want to hear a lot more from you when we come back from a quick break. We're listening to nurses this hour as we push into the 9th month of the COVID pandemic. We'll be back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the show, we will be speaking with Dr. David Satcher, former U.S. Surgeon General and former director of the CDC. Now, when Dr. Satcher was a young boy, he might have died of whooping cough had it not been for the help of the only black doctor in his hometown in Alabama. Well, of course, obviously, Dr. Satcher went on to dedicate his career to providing greater access to healthcare for Americans. And so we want to hear from doctors, from nurses, for people in public health, especially public health workers of color, what inspired you to pursue your career and what barriers have been presented to you and have you had to overcome? Call us at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683 for our show with Dr. David Satcher tomorrow. Today, we are talking with nurses from El Paso, Seattle, and New York about where healthcare is, where they are in terms of their professions as caring professionals as the United States continues to rise in terms of the numbers of positive COVID cases and the number of people dying. Now, we heard from nurses who called us to share their stories, and here's one. A nurse who said that he's concerned about what the public thinks of COVID-19.
Right now, it's just it's kind of scary that people are just thinking that this is fake. There's some people that we've taken care of who are still skeptical of what they have.
That's one of our listeners from San Antonio, a nurse from San Antonio, Texas. Laura Simons is a public health nurse at her local health department, and she called us to tell her about her frustration regarding the public's response to the pandemic.
We have a lot of people in the community that don't wear masks, and it's very frustrating. And we feel like we're beating our head against the wall to try to keep up with the cases and be responsive to the needs of the community when we're not seeing the public reciprocating with their behaviors, including our local county government.
That's Laura Simons, a public health nurse in Wisconsin. Now, Ellen, Mary Jo, and Juan, I want to ask you this straight on. I mean, Mary Jo, you kind of said it a little earlier, but Juan, have we, the public, let healthcare workers down?
I always like to look at the positive side, but in as a collective majority, I guess yes. Yeah, yes, absolutely. But maybe not so as a whole. The thing is, it comes from leadership. You know, when information is being disseminated that, you know, it's a hoax, and then they see that there's like lack of PPEs and maybe ventilators, especially in the beginning of the pandemic. You know, when you hear stuff like that, and that information gets brought down to the public, people start like, oh, it's a little flu. You know, we can go back to our lives. Why we shouldn't have to wear a mask. And that's, for me, very disappointing. You know, when you see and hear people posting on the internet things that are not truth, you know, and because we see it in the hospital, they don't, until it affects somebody or themselves.
Yeah, you know,
I'm very disappointed.
It's okay for you to say that, Juan. I mean, I understand wanting to like look for positivity or light even in the midst of darkness, and especially that seems like a core trait for people who go into the caring professions, I have to say. So I will express the frustration. I will, because for 9 months we have been talking about how those many, if not most, of the 260,000 plus Americans who have died did not need to die from COVID. That's the thing, right? This is preventable. There are countries on planet Earth that have not had a positive case since April. Okay, that is not here. And
that is unbelievable.
In March, we were talking about flattening the curve. Why? Flattening the curve so that people in the healthcare system could care for those who were most in need. That curve, that's not even a curve anymore. It's just a rocket ship going straight up. So I will express the frustration, because you guys have to work 12, 13, 14, 15-hour shifts with no relief, and people keep coming in and they're getting sicker and sicker. Either I had my moment, but we have let you down, is what I'm saying.
I do agree, because we never got off the first wave. I think the saying the second wave is coming is kind of a misnomer, because we never flattened the curve as a nation. Different states did, and now we're facing as a whole this whole pandemic all over again. And I don't think we've done due diligence as a public to help our community in masking up, you know, and the infodemic that's out there on social media has been creating such a social dilemma. And social media has been in kind of the gasoline, in a sense that the misinformation, the conspiracy theories of talking about no masking, the vaccines are not the real thing, this is a whole fake process, it's creating frustration with the healthcare workers. You know, we're preparing to be redeployed again, and if only we mask and social distance and just follow what the healthcare professionals have said, and to take care of each other, I think there what should have been more of a community work for it. That was one of the biggest things, is the infodemic is it's still not slowing down. It is on a rampant, and nurses are tired. You just see the burnt out. You know, just to talk about it and to relive that whole situation. We're tired. We're very tired.
Well, Mary Jo, we do have at least a couple of vaccines that might receive their emergency youth authorization pretty soon. You earlier were encouraging people to get the vaccines when they can. So, you know, perhaps there is that pinprick of light at the end of the tunnel.
There definitely is. There definitely is. I we're expecting some doses in December, but it'll be a while before there's enough to move from, you know, they have to do the essential workers first and the highest risk people, and it'll keep coming. And it's exciting to see that the second vaccine company has got their submitted to the FDA for emergency use. So that is exciting. But I think, like, to your point, I am angry when I see on the news, literally like a week ago, people protesting outside of a grocery store because they have to, why should they have to mask up to go into a grocery store? And it's about their right. No. It's not about your right. It's about you. You get in a car, you put a seatbelt on. It's what you do to protect yourself and and the community, right? This is about protecting yourself and your community. It is your responsibility to do it. It's not, it doesn't need to be political. You just wear a mask.
I want to we've just got a couple of minutes left with the three of you. And I wanted to be sure about something. Because the mental health impact is clearly so great on healthcare workers here. Have the three of you been able to, If you felt like you've needed help, have you been able to get help that you need?
For me, I have. I am very thankful that my organization has created a support and resources to get us through, and those resources are still available, and that I am grateful for. Also, nursing organizations have provided resources for nurses to get mental health. I actually availed for mental health resources just to get through the post-pandemic redeployment.
And Mary Jo, were you going to say something?
Yeah, I would say yes. UW Medicine's been really same thing. They have resources available to us. And then there are resources out there for any healthcare worker that might need it that does free work. I mean, the rate of suicide has gone up with healthcare workers. I think this is a very serious concern. But yes, and I think I do a lot of Zooming. I had a Zoom happy hour with some of my friends last week. I had not seen them for months, so it was great to see them. FaceTime with other people, and it just those little lifts. And then I think trying to get some normalcy back in my life as far as like getting my exercise on a routine basis and really watching my sleep and because that seems to be the things that help me. So I think it's figuring out what helps you and making sure time for it. I was listening to someone speak on resiliency, and basically they said, you know, you have to put it on your calendar to make it happen. Mm-hmm. And I think that's very true.
I'm taking notes here, Mary Jo.
I do agree, Mary Jo, with taking care of yourself. And I think nurses kind of lack that. You know, we want to take care of others. That's our personality. That is who we are. And when it comes to taking care of ourselves, we put ourselves last. And now it's time to put ourselves first in mental health, in physical health, and emotional health. Because if we can't take care of ourselves, our resilience is going to go down, and it's going to affect us more in the long run. And, you know, talking about suicide, that is a risk that if we don't start taking care of ourselves, we'll run into.
Yeah. Well, Juan, we've just got a couple of seconds here, but have you been able to get help if you've needed it?
The hospital does offer like a 1-800 number that we can talk to. But I think what we're doing right now is quite therapeutic. You know, venting and telling our point of view, you know, this is quite therapeutic.
Well, and hopefully helpful, because people need to hear. Helpful to you. Absolutely. And helpful to people listening, because we all need to know what's going on in those hospitals that are treating so many people. So I want to thank all three of you, Juan Anchondo in El Paso, Texas, Mary Jo Kelly in Seattle, Washington, and Ellen Arigarat in New York City, three nurses joining us today. Thank you all for being with us.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
Well, it would be remiss if I did not note explicitly that the U.S. healthcare system really relies on tens of thousands of workers. Nurses, of course, as we've heard this hour. Doctors, lab technicians, porters, food service workers, sanitation workers, many, many more. So finally today, there's this really important question. What draws them to these jobs? And in the midst of the pandemic, what is it about healthcare that's keeping them there? Well, Nina Geis is a nursing assistant in the orthopedic surgery unit at Garnet Health Medical Center in Middletown, New York.
We do a lot of direct patient care, things like assisting patients to walk or clean themselves, to check their vitals, just, you know, lots of those more intimate assistance that people cannot always do for themselves in a healthcare setting. As the summer came on and there were less cases of COVID coming into the hospital, we did start taking more of the elective surgeries, bringing in people who had skipped them or rescheduled because of COVID. I kind of saw that push going on for not wearing your mask and talking about all your personal freedoms, and it kind of made me a little bit frustrated and a little bit scared, I would say, because we've all seen this. We've had coworkers who are still having effects from this, even though they are now negative. Our facility actually lost a tech who is similar to my job title from our emergency department. And it still is something that is still very heavy on everybody. Of course, this is a person that, especially in that department, they worked with this person every single day. They were a team. They were a family. They work 13-hour shifts down there. And that person isn't here anymore. I don't choose to do my job because I make a lot of money, because I don't. To be very honest, I could go be a cashier at Aldi for just about the same amount of money. But the reason people do this work is because we care about human beings. I work nights, so I see lots of patients who will be a little confused. I don't know if you've ever had the moment where you sleep in a different position and you open your eyes and you don't see what you usually see and you're like, wait a second, where am I? And I can take some of that time at night to just talk to them so that they know that their fears, that their apprehensions, that their discomfort is something that's valid. You know, I've seen people who are very, very broken, and the spirit that human connection can give to someone in a hospital situation, I think it's important in every single person who works in a hospital, from the doctor to the nurse to nursing assistant people to our EVS and our food service. All of these people interact with every patient every single day, and we connect with them. And that's why I do it. I think that's why we all do.
Nina Geis. She's a nursing assistant in the orthopedic surgery unit at Garnet Health Medical Center in Middletown, New York. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices. And they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.